And welcome to a normal and not spooky episode of SciShow Tangents. We're all a little sad when the Halloween season ends. It is the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green. And joining me this week, as always, is science expert Sari Riley.
Hello.
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hello, also.
Sam, when does this episode of SciShow Tangents come out?
November 2nd.
So you cannot yet go to awesomesocks.club and sign up for a sock subscription that will eliminate the worry of needing to buy socks from your life while also donating all of the profits to charity instead of having your sock profit go to some stranger somewhere.
Uh-huh.
You're so lucky that you're hearing about it now before it opens so that you can remember that on November 5th, you can go and sign up at awesomesocks.club. But we'll probably also talk about it next week.
You can go to bftba.com and find the new SciShow Tangent sticker, though. Came out yesterday.
Oh, all right. Well, I didn't even know. So many integrations.
Uh-huh. Get a sticker. Put on your sock.
Or you can get like 50 stickers and just cover your feet in them.
Make them into socks.
Oh.
They are socks now.
Innovative.
And shoes. If you get like 400, they're shoes now.
I think you'd need way less than 400. I think you'd only need 100.
Well, but look, Sam, I'm trying to upsell them.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. These stickers are flimsy. You got to buy 400 to make them into shoes.
That's right. No, Dick can't tell people they're flimsy. They're high quality. They're high quality shoe stickers.
What if you want to become a morph suit of SciShow Tangent stickers? How many do you need, Sam?
Morph suit.
10,000.
That sounds very sweaty.
Oh, it sounds super comfortable, Hank. Please.
You'd be perfectly hairless after you were done as well.
I mean, all we need is one person to buy an entire morph suit of SciShow Tangent stickers.
Yeah.
So basically, we can spend a lot of money marketing to that one person. We just have to find them.
That is true. Our whale.
They are our whale, the SciShow Tangent sticker morph suit person. So let us know if you are that human or cow.
Yeah.
Take like 200,000 to cover a cow. 200,000 stickers. Now we're wealthy. Now we don't need anybody's money anymore. We're quitting the business.
We retired.
We don't need to be in tangents anymore. there is a space between SciShow Tangents being a good sustainable podcast and us making too much money and just being like, I don't care. I live in the Barbados. I don't care about science anymore.
Yeah. So buy just enough stickers, but not too many.
Every week here on Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts while also trying to stay on a topic, which is especially humorous after that intro. Our panelists are playing for glory and for Hank Bucks, which I will be awarding as we play. And at the end of the episode, one of them will be crowned the winner. Now, as always, we're going to introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem this week from me. Our bodies sense so many things so that we can know what is up and down and nice and bad and even fast and slow. We can smell the flowers, bitter and sours, and know when the cookie is sweet. But it's crucial to know when you're in the snow where you can find some heat. And so evolution granted us this special superpower so that we can know how good it feels to take a heated shower. But as for how it works, you'll have to ask again. And by again, I mean you'll have to ask your time-traveling friend. Because we know molecularly how sight and smell and sound work, but as for heat and cold, we're still laying the groundwork. Our bodies contain mysteries, both elegant and not, and one of them is how we tell whether something's cold or hot. Our topic for the day is heat. And I went to the internet to be like, hey, like, how does thermoreception work? And the internet was like, eh. Mm-hmm. Because all of science is like, eh. It's wild. There's one thing that we know. There's like kinds of diseases where your cilia, like throughout your body, cilia are constructed poorly, which can really negatively impact digestion and some other things. But it also decreases your sensitivity to heat. So people think that cilia must be involved.
What's
somehow
cilia?
They're like little like projections of cells that like are wiggly.
Oh, okay.
They're often used by single-celled organisms to like move around, but in your intestines they're used to absorb nutrients, increase the surface area of the cell. Anyway, Sari, I know that this is not as easy as a question as it might sound like, but what is heat?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. So if you think about... temperature is like a physical quantity of something.
Okay.
So like you can, that expresses how hot or cold something is. So like you, an object can be hot, an object can be cold, and it is a certain temperature. And that's something you can measure. Heat, you don't say an object has seven heat. Heat is something, is a quantity of energy that is transferred to or from something else. So like heat can be transferred from lemonade to ice cubes in the lemonade, or heat can be transferred from
an oven to a turkey.
Yeah.
Is heat the transfer itself, or is heat the thing being transferred?
It's the energy being transferred, I think.
Okay.
Because you can describe that. The unit of heat is joule. So
the,
you can
the
say
the singer
like,
from the 90s.
She is hot. And so everyone was like, how many joules do I have to look at once?
To boil a pot of water.
To boil a pot of water. And then they were like, ah, yes, that is one joule. Now joule is a French guy. No, he's English. Never mind.
Wow.
James Prescott Joule. His first two names sound less French.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah, so the unit is named after him. And heat is mostly used when you're describing thermodynamic systems. So like as things are getting hotter or getting colder, that's when like physicists and chemists are interested in heat as a concept. Mm. And the history is very weird. I don't know if you know this, Hank, but we've been confused about heat, not only in the present day, but also in the past. Yeah. And I love that the things that we made up to describe it.
Mm.
So one of the theories of heat was that there was a fire-like element called phlogiston.
Phlogiston?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Phlogiston. I'm glad you're here, so I didn't have egg on my face saying phlogiston like a dummy. But they, like, people were thinking that this like element was in things that combusted or rusted or had fiery things related to it, and it was like held within the thing that could catch on fire and then was released when that fire happened.
Yeah.
So it was like a hot element.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. So after phlogiston, then they upgraded to the caloric theory.
Okay.
Thought that heat was a fluid called caloric that flows from hot to cold. So we were getting like the flow of things and how heat is transferred, but we couldn't figure out what it was. It was like a fluid but also like a weightless gas that could seep in and out of pores and could just go wherever it needed to be. But like that is how we conceptualize heat as like you have more of a thing than you are hot. And if you have less of a thing, then you're not. Mm-hmm. Like the fashion spreads, you know. Mm-hmm. But then we started learning more about thermodynamics and conceptualizing heat as a variable and in like kinetic terms of how molecules are moving. We had to have an understanding of molecules and atoms first, and then we could apply that concept to what we know about temperature and extrapolate from there.
Hmm. I mean, it turns out to be a pretty confusing thing where it's like, okay, so it's an increased temperature is the molecules moving faster, which just doesn't seem right. It is such a clear sensation that I have physically when I touch something, but what's happening is like my molecules are starting to move faster and some system in my body is able to transmit that information, like take the knowledge of that information and transfer it to my brain as a sensation of heat. And when my molecules slow down, that is sensed as cold. It just seems way too fundamental to be real.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot to think about.
Like when I taste something, I'm tasting it. You know, it's like the chicken molecules hit my tongue and then my brain is like, chicken. But like that's not what's happening with heat. It's like, it's not like chemical sensing. It's like feeling the molecules move around. Oh. Mm, I don't like it.
Yeah. Getting some of their wiggle into your body.
Yeah. Or they say they suck your wiggle out. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the two things that happen.
Do they suck your wiggle out? Okay.
Yeah, if you stick your head in a refrigerator, it sucks your wiggle right out of you.
That's right. You go outside in the winter in Montana.
My wiggle.
That's going to suck your wiggle out.
Give me back my
wiggle.
Then
you go get a hot cup of coffee and you put that wiggle back in.
Okay, okay. Now I get it.
Sam's on board.
Yeah, so replace caloric with wiggles and then you've got
heat.
Yeah,
and all your stuff's just bumping around more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word heat, it seems like we've probably been dealing with being warm for a while. So I'm going to go ahead and guess that one's been with us since the Proto-Indo-European root.
Yes, indeed. But there's actually two.
Oh.
I think everyone was confused about heat. So it seems like, from my understanding, there's a Proto-Indo-European root meaning to heat or warm, like the verb, which is G-W-H-E-R.
Okay.
And so that's the That's the root for things like thermal or like brandy or a lot. I don't know. These letters change sounds a lot, I think. But there's a lot of things that derive from that root that mean like to heat or to be warm. But hot and heat, like with the huh sound, they came from the same source as Old English hat and heida or something, meaning hot weather. So it's like the word for hot, we are not sure where it came from.
Okay. Because the caveman went, huh? And then from there, the rest was history.
I think you've cracked it, Sam.
And so it's time to move on to the quiz portion of our show. This week, we'll be going to be playing a game of this or that. Do you guys remember how this or that works?
Uh-huh. It's either this one or that one.
That's right. Yeah.
Is it hot or not?
No, it is actually, it's hot or hotter is kind of the vibe of this one. So as Sari just told us, heat and temperature are different things. Temperature is a measure of the energy of the molecules inside something. Heat is describing the flow of energy between things. Today, we're going to play a this or that heat edition. I'm going to present you with two things that have different temperatures, and it's up to you to figure out which one is hotter than the other one.
Ooh, okay.
It's pretty easy to figure out. So we have round number one, body temperature edition. Animal bodies, including our bodies, have different needs when it comes to regulating their body temperature. We might live in a hot environment or have a very active life or have feathers or fur that trap our body heat. And if our animal bodies exceed the temperature that we're, like the animal sort of evolved to exist in, we can get really sick unless we find some ways to get rid of that heat. So, which of the following is hotter? A flying pigeon or the hottest ever fever recorded and survived by a human?
Whoa. Gosh, I think animals run real hot and people can't. So I don't think it goes pigeon.
You think it's a hot pigeon?
I think that's one hot pigeon.
Oh my gosh. I was thinking the opposite. I just don't know how hot pigeons are. I've never touched one. So I'm going to say humans because I think we're hardy. And I know there was weird experiments with like intentionally causing fevers at some point.
In 1980, a man named Willie Jones, he had a temperature of 115 degrees Fahrenheit. That's over 2,000 wiggles after he was admitted to the hospital because of heat stroke. So it wasn't a fever from an illness. He was in a very hot place. So he had this heat stroke fever and he survived after being in the hospital for 24 days. And that is hotter than a flying pigeon, but not by as much as you might think. Scientists studying pigeon flight found that on a 34 mile per hour flight, which is very fast, pigeons exceeded an average body temperature of 111.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, wow.
That's up from its normal temperature of 107.8. So they're just burning that glycogen. It's creating some heat. Which brings us to round number two. So this is the geology round of this or that heat edition. The Earth is situated at a nice location in our solar system that makes life as we know it possible. But life at the surface is much different from at the Earth's core. So, which is hotter? Lava as it erupts out of a volcano on the surface of Earth or the daytime surface temperature of Venus?
Oh, no.
Damn. I don't have a concept for how hot either are, but
I'm going to guess Venus just because it's closer to the sun. The problem is I don't know enough about its atmosphere, like how much it is shielded from that solar radiation, but it seems hot and bad there.
Yeah.
So
it's only hot and bad there.
I'm going to say that.
I was leaning towards Venus too, because like maybe its radiant temperature is more than the lava.
Oh, it's radiant temperature.
I don't know. It's something temperature, Hank. I don't know what any kind of temperatures are. Maybe it's atmospheric temperature or whatever.
Okay, so you're going with Venus, both of you going with Venus?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up question, which is, what is Venus made out of?
Rock?
Yeah, rock is a good answer.
Right.
And the rock on the surface of the Venus
is solid.
Is not lava.
It is solid.
It's not melting.
Yeah.
This would have been a good question to ask before we gave our answers, Hank. You could have really helped out.
So Venus is the hottest planet in our solar system, not just because it's closer to the sun, but also its dense carbon dioxide atmosphere. As we've heard, carbon dioxide, good at trapping heat. So the surface of Venus reaches 880 degrees Fahrenheit. Mercury, only 800 degrees Fahrenheit during the day, and negative 290 at night. Meanwhile, the temperature of lava erupting out of the Hawaiian volcano Kilauea is around 2,140 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, the lava does cool down quickly after being exposed to air, going down by hundreds of degrees each second. So just at that moment when it hits there, it is very, very, very hot.
We beefed it completely.
Yeah, that was pretty embarrassing, but, you know.
All right, let's see if you can make up for it with round three, which is we're zooming out even further into the cosmic edition. Quasars are very bright objects in space. They're thought to be early stage galaxies and to be powered by supermassive black holes. And one of the first quasars to be discovered was 3C273, which was discovered by astronomer John Boston in the early 1960s. So which is hotter, the center of quasar 3C273 or the hottest temperature ever made by man?
We can do some pretty fucked up stuff, so.
I imagine they would both be like some sort of like nuclear fission or fusion or something like that, right? Like,
yeah.
Hot elements doing something. Mm-hmm.
That would be like the same as whatever's going on in whatever quasar, mm-hmm. but more so perhaps. Or Hank will make fools of us again. I'm going to say human created is hotter.
Yeah, I guess. So if it was human created, you could see the hot quasar and then be like, I can do one hotter and then make something slightly hotter. That's a very human thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to be made a fool of, but I'm going to guess the quasar because I don't understand space things. And I'm just like, oh, it's in space. It's hot. It's extreme.
All right. Well, here's a little story for you. In 2012, scientists at CERN's Large Hadron collided lead ions to create a quark gluon plasma, the mass of subatomic particles that might have existed before the Big Bang, which resulted in a temperature of around 9.9 trillion degrees Fahrenheit, which is very hot, but it is not as hot as the core of a quasar.
No.
Yes.
Yes, it is. It's hotter. It's hotter.
In 2016, scientists studying that quasar with a Russian satellite found that the core of the quasar measured around 18 trillion degrees Fahrenheit, which is not just hotter than CERN, it's hotter than what theoretical predictions had said was possible for a quasar, which is about 179 billion degrees Fahrenheit. So very, very different from that. That discrepancy points to mysteries in how quasars emit light and how the molecules inside of it are interacting that we have not yet solved. Wow. That's hot. Trillions of degrees.
Yeah. My head can't even wrap around how hot it is.
No. All right. Well, congratulations to Sari for coming out with 2 points, to Sam's none. Next, we're going to take a short break and then it will be time for the fact off. Welcome back, everybody. It's time for the Fact Off. Our panelists have brought science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind. After they have presented their facts, I will judge them and award Hank bucks any way I see fit. Sam is currently 2 points behind, so he will have to have his fact be twice as good as Sari's for a win to be in his future, which, look, buddy, it's possible. You could do it. And I judge these based on which one I want to turn into a TikTok, and then I turn it into a TikTok, which do very well. So good job bringing me good science fact.
I think it makes people listen to our show, too.
I think it's made people sign up for the show, which...
I love this.
I'm glad that they're here for this mess of goofiness. But to decide who goes first, I have a trivia question for you. Millions of people experience hot flashes, and contrary to what the name might suggest, the symptoms aren't just feeling hot. During a hot flash, many people's metabolic rate increases, with associated heart rate increases by about 7 to 15 beats per minute. But that's not to say you don't also get hot. So based on readings from a finger monitor, what is the average body temperature increase during a hot flash?
Well, it's not more than like 10 degrees. It can't be that.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise that dude did die almost at 115. Yeah. Like, he did max out. So it's not going to take you above 115.
I feel like you can also feel extremely hot and then take your temperature and be like, I am not I am normal. So
it's weird, those moments where you're just like, ah, my everything. And then you take your temperature, it's like 99.6. And you're like, I am bad at, I'm just a very whiny person. Yeah.
My proteins.
I have such a good, like, I'm melting, but instead, like, the Wicked Witch gets water poured on, and she's like, my proteins, they're denaturing.
I think that the answer to this question is 0.4.
That's so low. I think the answer to this question is 3.
That seems like a lot.
The average finger temperature increased 2.7 degrees Celsius during a hot flash. Wow. Sari's the winner.
Bazinga.
All right. So, Sari, that means you get to decide who goes first.
And I'll go first. So, like Hank was saying, mammals, like humans, expend quite a bit of energy to keep our bodies toasty warm. But other animals, like many reptiles, are ectothermic and mostly rely on external factors for temperature control. And I have just kind of assumed that plants are also beholden to the whims of their environment. They can either just tolerate the cold or the heat or die off and regrow. And for the most part, this is true. But there are a handful of thermogenic plants, plants that can generate heat from within and raise their temperature far above the air that surrounds them. So, for example, the skunk cabbage doesn't sound or look like much. It grows near the ground in wetlands across the North American continent and is kind of brownish, greenish, and stinky.
I've seen some skunk cabbage in my time.
I haven't. I'm excited to see one now, though. I'm going to go looking. Because in March, when the ground is often still frozen and covered in snow or ice, you might see a small melted spot surrounding one of these little guys. For about 2 weeks, a modified leaf pokes out of the ground, protecting a cluster of flower heads called the spadix. And even when air temperatures are below freezing, the spadix is around 15 to 35 degrees Celsius hotter than its surroundings. Almost like it's a tiny animal, the skunk cabbage generates this heat through cellular respiration, using up oxygen and sugars like starch in the process. And cellular respiration, as anyone who's had to memorize it for a test knows, has a lot of different steps and proteins and genes involved. And for those nerds like me, it seems like thermogenic plants may use pathways that animals don't, but exact biochemical process is a botanical mystery. It likely involves classes of compounds called alternative oxidases or plant uncoupling mitochondrial proteins.
What?
Or pumps, which is confusing because there are protein pumps too.
Yeah.
But they don't use cytochrome C oxidase, which is that big one that you learn about at the end of the electron transport system in biochemistry. This is a little in the weeds, but I was like, that's very weird. So I decided to include it in my fact. And biochemistry aside, it's strange that a plant would expend all this energy to bloom a little bit earlier instead of just waiting for the weather to change. So the other botanical mystery in play is why these hot plants exist. The main guess is that the warm, radiant heat helps circulate air around the flower head, like how hot and cold pockets of air in the atmosphere create wind. And this wafts stinky organic compounds through the air to attract pollinators. Another guess is that what fly or beetle or spider wouldn't want to hunker down in a cozy, stinky plant when it's cold outside? But besides the skunk cabbage, most thermogenic plants are in more tropical environments, so this might not be as likely. But either way, these weird warm plants exist, and now I want to touch one.
Can I get enough together to, like, warm me up? If I'm just, like, wilderness survival time, and I've gotten out in a swamp in the cold. Can I just, like, gather up a bunch of skunk cabbage and be like, warm my body?
My guess is no, because the heat would dissipate probably pretty quickly. Like, they need to be rooted and metabolizing in order to produce that heat. But maybe if you, like, if you planned ahead before you became a survivalist and, like, planted a grove of them, then you might have a little warm pocket.
That's cool. I had no idea about that. And there's lots of skunk cabbage in Montana. I've seen it around. I've never, like, approached any because it's swampy where they are. So I'm like, I'm going to stay over here where my boots are not covered in mud. But now I kind of want to go touch one.
Yeah.
All right, Sam, what do you got for me?
What do you think of when you think of ice? Do you think of cubes floating around in a refreshing summer beverage? Or maybe icicles hanging from a festively lit home on a cold Christmas morn? Above all, you think about ice, you think about cold. So what am I doing talking about ice in an episode about heat? Well, what if I told you that some ice could be quite hot indeed?
Hot ice.
First of all, this fact off might be a bit of a team effort because it turns out that ice is weird as fuck and I'll probably get something wrong. Second of all, ice becomes ice at 32 degrees Fahrenheit when it's on Earth, right? So water becomes ice at 32 degrees. But as pressure increases, the freezing point of water changes. So under a little bit more pressure, the freezing point gets lower. But once you start putting enough pressure on it, the freezing point increases. So on other planets with different conditions, you can get all types of wacky ice with all types of wacky freezing points. So one place in the universe with lots of water under super extreme pressure is the core of gas giants like Uranus and Neptune. The water there could be under so much pressure, in fact, that scientists figure there must be some really weird hot ice down there. Ice that would, according to egghead math, have a solid lattice of oxygen atoms with hydrogen atoms sloshing around inside like a liquid. So they've called this hypothetical form of water super ionic ice, and I suppose probably contented themselves to never seeing it because we do not live in the core of Neptune. But in 2019, scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in Livermore, California, used six, quote, giant lasers to create shockwaves that compress liquid water to between 1 and 4 million times Earth's atmosphere and heated it to between 3 and 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And the thing that they thought would happen, super ionic ice, happened. So super ionic ice formed for like literally a nanosecond, and they took some X-ray measurements to prove it or something.
That's what
and
they do.
Another team in New York did like the same thing at the same time, and they both got the same results. So I guess that settles that.
Nice. Yeah.
So they call the ice Ice 18, and it is thought in its natural environment that is probably black and four times heavier than our boring old Earth ice. And since there are lots of big, gassy, water-filled planets out there, it's also thought that it might even be one of the most common forms of water in the whole universe. Since on Earth, it only exists for a nanosecond after being shot by six giant lasers, it's not really that useful to us for any practical reason. But knowing that it can exist, it gives us a better understanding of how planets work when they have watery cores. And it also seems to be superconductive, so it might help to explain some previously mysterious magnetic fields that we've seen in the universe.
Okay.
And maybe there are aliens out there with 8,000 degree drinks that need to be cooled off.
So, Sam, I gotta say, I don't care that much about how this helps us understand other planets. You just told me that there is black ice that is four times heavier than ice, but it's still water ice. It's got a like a liquid soup of hydrogen inside of it and is potentially superconducting.
Yeah.
And that we made it on Earth.
Yeah.
And it's potentially the most common form of ice in the universe.
Uh-huh.
I don't care about any practical use for this knowledge.
Well, you know,
I just care that that is a thing.
What's this do for me?
What can I do with 8,000 degree ice?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Anyway, since that one shook me to my core of Ice 18, I'm going to call this one a tie.
What? You can't just let me win.
No, absolutely not. Sari had 2 points coming into that.
Does this mean you're going to make both of them into TikToks again?
No, I think I'm going to make Sam's into a TikTok.
So then Sam wins. I think that's only fair.
Yeah, but you won the other one. The points have to mean something, I guess. I humbly accept my basically defeat.
It's now time to ask the Science Couch, where we've got a listener question for our virtual couch of finely honed scientific minds. It's from at Joshi Joestar, who asks, why is my breath warm when I say ha, but it's cool when I say whoo?
It's great. It's a superpower that we all have. It's fun.
I have a guess, as I usually do. When I go ha, the air is coming out nice and slow, and it's sort of in a nice big fat column of hot air. And when I go, I'm blowing air, and it's sucking a lot of air in from outside and move like it's creating this like vacuum. Basically, it's being filled. But the reason it feels cool is because there's more molecules hitting your fingers where you're feeling it, and those are room temperature molecules, but you're getting hit by more molecules, so there's more wiggles going into the air than are staying in your fingers.
That's pretty much it. Science man Hank. All I have is a couple more fancy words to describe what you're saying, but yeah, it's basically it's a matter of turbulent flow. So turbulence is something that exists not only in airplanes, but in any sort of fluid. So like gas or a liquid that is flowing. And there is laminar flow, which is where the fluid moves in like very smooth layers. And then there's turbulent flow, which is where it like swirls around. And that's like what's happening when you blow air out of your mouth. It's not moving perfectly. Like there's tons of different swirly bits of how your mouth is shaped and the air is being pushed out, but also just the air currents around in the room. And I don't want to just repeat what you said, but yeah, you're blowing out air in a less directed way when you go ha, and it doesn't grab as much nearby air. Mm-hmm. And when you blow air in a more directed way, it like swoops up the room temperature air and feels cool like a breeze. But if you like blow, if you go who, and you put your hand really close to your mouth, it still feels warm because it hasn't had time to like suck up that air. Or if you like blow through a tube, then it also doesn't have time or the space to get all turbulent with the other air to hit you. So it is in the way that any sort of temperature is kind of like an illusion of just there's more space, there's more molecules mixing up, which makes it feel different to you.
What a world. If you want to ask the Science Couch your question, you can follow us on Twitter. It's at SciShow Tangents, where we will tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Thank you to at Vanya Tweets, at TR Anson, and everybody else who tweeted us your questions for this episode. If you like this show and you want to help us out, it's very easy to do that. You can go to our Patreon at patreon.com/SciShowTangents to become a patron and get access to things like our newsletter and our bonus episodes where we are even more goofy than we are here. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That's helpful and it helps us know what you like about the show. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us.
And buy stickers, too.
10,000 minimum. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Caitlin Hoffmeister and Sam Schultz, who edits a lot of these episodes, along with Hiroko Matsushima. Our social media organizer is Paolo Garcia Prieto. Our editorial assistants are Deboki Chakravarti, Emma Dowster, and Alex Billow. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish, and we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you, and remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted. But one more thing. Heat has long been used as a tool to join things together, for example, through welding. Specifically, butt welding is the term used to describe joining two pieces of metal by aligning their ends and then heating them up. But the heat can come in many different forms. Resistance butt welding passes a current through the metals, and the resulting resistance generates so much heat that it softens the metals to join them. There's also laser butt welding that indirectly heats ions by heating electrons with light. And there's ultrasonic butt welding that heats metals with high frequencies that make low amplitude vibrations. There's so many ways to make a butt out of metal.
That's a stretch, huh? That ain't about butts.
It's a bit, I mean, a little, but like, I did get to say ultrasonic butt welding.
That's true.
That seems like a butt fact to me.
You can make it about your butt, too. Ultrasonic butt welding sounds like a way to describe, like, when you sit on a plasticky chair and your butt really sticks to it, then it's like, oh, that's freaking ultrasonic butt welding going on down there.
Especially when you have to stand back up. Yeah. That's the ultrasonic part, because you can hear it.